Hello and welcome to RCR Talk. This is Jasprit Boparai here with Don Nicholson, and today we are talking PAR, and not the kind that goes straight to a head, which might be the sort most of us have seen around in New Zealand recently. This is the kind that makes our world go round. Electricity, energy, in whatever way you may need it, as we all do in our everyday lives. And we are bringing you a guest who you might have heard on the airwaves a couple of times in the past, but for the first time, you're going to see him in person. But before we go on to get Larry to speak a bit more about himself, this is his excellent Substack. For those who are on the Substack app, this is newzealandenergy.substack.com. And he's quite a regular poster, short blogs that come off a couple of times a week. And I cannot recommend this highly enough. I know I read it frequently. I know, Don, you do too. So welcome, Larry Blair. Good to have you back on with us. And for most of our listeners, you are a new face. So would you please tell us more about yourself?
Yeah, good evening, Don, Jaspreet. That's nice to talk to you again. I originally trained in instrumentation, so industrial measurement control. And then I did a bit of study in heavy electrical systems as well. I've been in the energy industry for 25 years now, most of it in the oil and gas, and most of it sort of project management and consultancy type roles. So yeah, energy is probably more of a the wider context of energy is more of a hobby and interest to me than anything, but yeah, that's where I come from on this discussion.
So where has your career taken you? You're a Taranaki boy, I understand, but overseas as well?
Yeah, well, obviously Taranaki's a bit of an energy hub, or has been historically in New Zealand, particularly in the oil and gas space. So that was the catalyst that got me started. And then from there, I've worked in Norway, in Singapore, in China. Those are the main places. But yeah.
And safe to say, a quarter of a century later, it's still the subject still enthralls you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I just get more passionate about it every day. And a lot of what I was trying to do with the Substack was just help people develop more energy literacy and tie it back to the wider boundary biological systems and the imperative for growth and all of those things. Like, where do these innate primordial things come from, and how do they translate into energy?
And I really enjoy the way it is laid out on a Substack. You know, number one, most of us are stretched for time. It is short, snappy, to the point. But more than anything, you make it very obvious to the reader how it impacts him or her in our everyday lives. And as I've seen your Substack, especially over the last 2 months, you're warning Kiwis, aren't you?
Well, I mean, I think it resonates in some ways because it's the stuff you know, but you don't know that you know, if that makes sense. Yeah, like people have an intuition around energy because it's so important to us, right? But that intuition's been somewhat dampened just due to the ubiquitous nature of energy these days. It's everywhere and it's all over the place, right? So we don't have to think about it as much as when we had to find a meal and a way to heat ourselves each day, right? So, but it's the same ideas.
Because one is used to scary headlines, isn't one, Don, around coming into winter, but peak summer, the sun is shining, everything is well. And yet there is a Substack every week, at least twice a week, warning us that, yeah, things are going to get real here.
Yeah, so I did a post a while back, it's probably a month or so now, the 2025 energy stocktake, and it was purely looking at that. So Don will recall when I first started writing, my biggest concern was the absence of gas in the market. And I was infuriated at the time because I was reading this stuff from MBIE, and they were telling me we've got gas out to 2046 and it's going to be the transition fuel and all of these things, right? And then I was looking on their website at the reserve profile for all of the fields in New Zealand, and you could run a ruler through it and you'd see this, it's like a 45 degree angle decline. And I'm like, oof, I don't know where they get these numbers from. It just doesn't make any sense, right? So fast forward to today, and yeah, we're short of gas in a really big way. And then you add that to the fact that we had a dry winter last year. We didn't get a lot of snowfall, and that snowpack is what feeds those hydro systems in the South Island during the summer. Well, keeps them buoyant, right? And so that's absent. And then now we've had sustained periods of low rainfall, so the inflows to that system are lower than usual. The lakes have just gone recently, they've gone below average. And unless they get a lot of rain between now and winter and through winter, in the absence of natural gas, we've got some real challenges. So
And in the recent days, we've had some businesses saying that they're making contingency plans already for a stressed, at least winter period, if not into the spring this year, because of lack of energy. Is
yeah, so
do you think they've got what sounds like they've got valid reasons to be very concerned?
I think they do, and it's a really funny sort of dynamic going on at the moment. So you've got the average New Zealander probably doesn't see it too much. They would have noticed a little bit this week because they got a letter from their power companies. I think, well, I did. I'm assuming most people did, but there's a reasonably big increase. Some people double digit in terms of their unit price of electricity. And then they would have also seen their line charges going up. And some of those are quite big as well, like I think 100% in some cases. So that's when you start to feel it. You go, well, if you're not following the situation, you're like, what's going on? But what was happening last year throughout the winter is that the big users, big industrial users in New Zealand actually did this thing called demand management. And I hate that term because that's an abject failure of the system if we've got to do demand management. What that means is that we're turning things off just to keep the lights on, right? I know that sounds a bit odd, but so what happened was that Methanex is a great big industrial gas user, basically shut down their production and on-sold their gas into the market to keep the electrical grid up. So that, it might sound all very generous and all that sort of thing. I mean, obviously they make margin on selling the gas in, but the problem is that that's a domestic production activity that stops, and it's an export market that's not satisfied with product, right? So last year, I think Methanex produced 670,000 tons of methanol, roughly, and the year before it was nearly double that. So that's the sort of impact that this sort of curtailment has. And then at the same time, you also had Tiwai reduce their output by about 30% as well. So that's the aluminium smelter. And that was to gain just to redirect electricity into the grid just to keep the grid going. Meanwhile, all that's happening and the spot market prices are up over $1,000 a megawatt hour. And that's coming off a base that should be around 150. So you can kind of see what's going on, right? And anyone that's in that wholesale market's experiencing that. Whereas, like, I'm paying, say, 33 cents a kilowatt hour for my domestic power in the house. And often and regularly, the wholesale electricity price is sort of in that $400 range, which equates to 40 cents a kilowatt hour. So you can see where this is all going, right? Like, they can't, like, we're almost being subsidized in the fact that our power bills are lower than the generation cost in the wholesale market. So that's why those increases that we got this week are going to keep coming.
And that is worrying, isn't it? You also mentioned in one of your substacks about the BNZ Business New Zealand Performance Manufacturing Index report. They talk about the PMIs. And looking at this report, this is from January this year, talking of the December doldrums. A PMI reading above 50 indicates that manufacturing is expanding in the country. It's an index to see, I guess, your level of industrialization. And the December PMI was 45.9. This sector has now been in contraction for 22 consecutive months. And the worst thing about this report is that this is the first time in the survey's history that all the last 12 months were in contraction. So for a layperson like me, this is We are deindustrializing. And BNZ says the next closest to this horrible 2024 report was 2008, in the height of the global financial crisis. And even then, the contraction was only in 9 of the 12 months. Last year, 12 out of 12 months, the business index showed a contraction. This eerily reminds me of what's happened in Germany. Are we deindustrializing? We have seen some of the bigger industries in regional New Zealand go out last year, paper mills and others. Is there worse to come yet?
Yeah, I mean, so my concern is that yeah, this is a trend that's baked in now because we're starting to see. I wrote an article and it was about the Seneca Cliff, and it was basically is a little catchphrase like, "How did I go bankrupt? Gradually." Sorry, "How did I go bankrupt? I went bankrupt in two ways: gradually, then suddenly." Right, so. Things once you get a bit of a momentum in the wrong direction, it amplifies, right? So we're seeing things like I think it's the Commerce Commission is looking at. So obviously the Commerce Commission regulates the distribution networks, both Transpower and the local distribution, and agrees on what prices they can increase by. They also do the same thing in the gas market. And they're looking at the gas market at the moment and they're going, what happens if one of the big users, and I think that was code language for Methanex, was to drop out of the market? How do we cover the cost of this distribution network over a much smaller customer base, right? So then you see things like, I know. One of the guys that I work with at the moment, he received a letter this week, and they basically that his gas supplier, which is here in Taranaki as well, said that they'll be no longer supplying gas to his house, and he'd need to find a new supplier. So, like you're seeing this move away from gas, but it's not a move into something else in a lot of cases. If these things can just they'll either just stop or they go to a completely different market somewhere else overseas, right? So I also had a discussion with a big employer in the Waikato, and they're looking at expanding their operation, and they're wondering whether New Zealand's actually the right place to do it. So these are the sorts of things that happen when you've got the cost of energy is too high.
Yeah, and we've been talking about this ad infinitum that a flourishing economy, in a country is, it requires low cost, abundant energy. Why is it? Why is it that we've got a growing population, a growing demand? We would love to have more industry, but we've just don't have this security of supply effectively, and yet we've got all the people analyzing this stuff in suits in Wellington. I mean, I used to work in this industry a little bit, and there's plenty of people making a lot of decisions that just don't appear to hit the mark.
Well,
Is that too harsh?
no, it's not. I don't think it is. I think there's two sort of blinkers on here, right? One blinker is the market, right? We've got to have a market. Like we're ideologically wedded to the idea that there's a market. The other ideological blinker is that it's got to be renewables. Anything that comes as added, it's got to be renewable, right? So there's these two sort of guide rails that control the path of thought, right? So you can't think outside either of those guardrails. And so that boxes us into a lot of really narrow solutions that don't have sort of really long lifetimes for, where there's a lot of excess capacity and that supports a lot of growth and a lot of development of business. So that would be my sort of initial thoughts. Just jumping back a sec there, Don, I just want to correct you on a couple of things. So there's actually demand's falling off for electricity. It's down 3.2% this December on last December. That's a function of the big industrial users. And the big industrial users use a lot more electricity than residential historically. However, and this is another data point in the deindustrialization, is that residential use of electricity has just gone past for the first time industrial use. So industrial use is falling away and residential use is following a pretty predictable gradual increase. So
Well,
yeah, that's not a good.
no, that's
that can't be
a
a
hell of
good.
a red flag, and we're not reading about it in mainstream anyway. That's the first time I've heard that. So thank you, Larry, for putting that in front of us. I mean, the next question, without discounting that, the next question I'd like to ask is, what influences the 2019 Climate Change Response Zero Carbon Amendment Act had? I mean, we're 6 years into that, almost, effectively 6 years in, and it seems that every year we're having these discussions even to a more intense level. Has it had a negative effect?
I don't think it's had much effect at all, right? I mean, and the reason I say that is because, as I predicted a couple of years back, the transition's from gas to coal, right? And this is exactly what's happening. The gas is dropping off, and the coal imports are increasing. So, I mean, last year we went into winter with something like 750,000 tons of coal. This year, Genesis was going into it with about 550, and then recently the whole industry's got together and with those concerns that we talked about at the start about the absence of gas and the hydro in lake inflows, and subsequently they've ordered more coal, and I think we'll probably have a stock at something like 800,000 tons as we head into winter this year.
But that counts as the country from which we are importing their emissions, isn't it? So we can keep our emissions locked in, good quality coal, and we get slightly inferior coal to from what I
Well,
understand.
we still burn it here, but like that's the, I mean,
But
yeah.
yeah, it's funny. So that effectively there that fuel is going up in the air here. I would prefer that a New Zealand coal, which is more clean burning, gets burnt here. Plus, of course, the emissions to get it over here, but somehow we are up into some very creative accounting there. And since we speaking about coal and importing coal, much of ours, if I'm correct, comes from Indonesia, right?
Yeah, I think all of it comes from Indonesia.
And your recent Substack highlighted the possible vulnerability with the, China now conducting live trials and all sorts of military war games there in the Tasman, that if there is further escalations of tensions in this area, the Strait of Malacca, that gets to be a choke point for our imports.
Yeah, so the Strait of Malacca is an interesting proposition for New Zealand. We've largely, I don't know what the commercial reasons are. I assume it's just because capacity and pricing, which would be the two things that I would expect would drive that. But over recent years, we've concentrated a lot more of our purchases for refined goods, so diesel, petrol, jet fuel, in Singapore and Malaysia. And both of those are, well, particularly the refineries in West Malaysia, are all located in the Malacca Strait. And the Malacca Strait is a strategic choke point where you would interrupt shipping if you were trying to prevent China from getting oil. And China doesn't have a lot of domestic oil. So the red flag for me was this, obviously China and has issues with Australia and the US at the moment. We would have thought they're at a pretty low level, and hopefully they'll stay that way. I think they need each other more than they dislike each other. But the general thesis there was that, if we're going to have military drills between us in the Tasman between Australia and New Zealand, then that could, if it was to escalate, disrupt our shipping, and we're dependent on shipping for everything now, coal, diesel, petrol, jet fuel, and getting our commodities out to market as well.
So, who's ever thought that mothballing Marsden Point was a great idea?
Yeah, I mean, that was an interesting discussion at the time, and again, it was, I think there was a lot of ideological blinkers there. I don't think the unit cost per liter of fuel from Marsden Point could compete with the other refineries, the overseas refineries. I think, just the age of it, the upgrades it needed, it couldn't compete there. One of the problems was that they did want to look at an upgrade, and I believe they, I'm not 100% sure of these figures, but I think it was something like 2 to 3 cents a litre levy they wanted to put on petrol to help cover the capital cost of those upgrades. And that was obviously rejected by the government of the time. In hindsight, too, I think it would be difficult now with the absence of gas. So the refinery did use a fair bit of gas from from Taranaki via pipeline to run it. So whether that gas, sufficient gas, would be available to support that operation now, I'm not sure. Which is, I mean, this is just another function of this gas falling out of the market. It wasn't very long ago in the big scheme of things. Like, what we're talking pre-COVID, we were sort of in using 150 to 200 petajoules, which is a lot of energy from gas, and that's largely gone. So that's all energy transformations that turn into economic activity, right? Because the economy is literally energy transformed. So if that energy is not there, then we're doing less productive, we've got less production.
Is there a new process or a better process for refining fuels without the use of gas? Could, if New Zealand was to start from ground zero now, what would we do?
Oh, you just use more of the crude in the front end for process heat, right? So
Right.
that's basically how it would work, yeah. Yep.
Right. So, aside from the electricity issues that we have, and maybe we might talk about the nuclear, being nuclear free stance, anti-nuclear stance we've got. I mean, if we'd had a nuclear power plant from day one, say 25 years ago, it would have paid for itself by now. Would that have been a remedy that would have helped New Zealand through this pinch point? Would it have made us
Yeah,
an attractive place for business?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, like there was the New Zealand Energy, I forget the name, I forget the acronym, but the state-owned, when before the Bradford reforms, when everything was broken up, the all the energy generation in the country was all nationalized and run by the state. And they had plans at that time in the mid 70s to build a nuclear power station, 1 gigawatt, so quite a big bit of kit, in the Kaipara Harbour, I think it was, or on the edge of the Kaipara Harbour. I mean, obviously, they'd progressed this quite far, and they were sending people off on training and all sorts of stuff. So they were obviously quite keen on this. And I would say that the government at that time, was pretty aspirational. This has come on the back of a lot of activity at that time. So all that think big stuff was happening around that time. And if we'd gone ahead with that the cost of that plant would be fully amortized now, and you still have 40 to 50 years of operational life of it. And it would be generating power at incredibly low rates. And it's really good quality power too, right? It's base load, it's not weather dependent. It can be modulated a little bit. It prefers to be steady state, but then you couple that with your hydro schemes, and wow, you'd be the envy of the world. You'd have a zero emission electrical system, and it'd have a huge amount of resilience in it, and scope
Yeah,
for growth.
and a lot of people still hanker for the anti-nuclear stuff. They hanker for holding us back because we're this little enclave in the South Pacific that needs to be, holier than thou on lots of issues. It's a bit like changing subject again, going back to liquid fuels. About the early 1980s, I remember the Liquid Fuels Trust Board coming around my farm and drilling holes, and that was the proposal, was to perhaps look for lignite to make diesel from. And that hasn't progressed. Here we are, 50 years on almost, and it seems to be because it's that dirty brown stuff out in the ground. We're just not supposed to use it. But the contradiction is we are using it. We're importing it to use it to make electricity. So there's a lot of contradictions in our administrations and governing class, I think.
Yeah, so we've got a really difficult paradox sitting in front of us now, right? So We don't like recessions. Recessions cause people to lose jobs. They cause businesses to close. They lower the standard of living. They erode the value of anything that you've got in terms of stores of value. So your real estate, your banking savings, your pension fund, everything gets eroded in value if there's recession, right? Recession is really bad, right? And recession is just another name for degrowth, right? So you're not growing. So there's a perfect relationship between change in GDP and change in net primary energy on a global scale. And when you look at a country, you can manipulate that a little bit, but essentially it's saying the same thing, right? That you want to grow, you need more energy. And if we want to maintain on average 2% growth per annum to provide a future with opportunities for our children and for them to have a better life than we had, then we need to double the size of our energy system within about 30 years. So all the problems we've got now, we need to be more aspirational, we need to be thinking bigger, and we need to be having a view that, hey, in 30 years we need to have twice as much energy as we've got now, and in 30 years we need twice as much more again. So and we seem to have lost that thinking, and I think it's just it's a function of those Bradford reforms, and it's a function of breaking up all of those, that state generation system into these smaller chunks. And I'll be the first one to say, the state couldn't run a bath, so they should not go anywhere near running something like that. But we do need that sort of collective scale of it. We're quite small as a country. We need to have a mechanism where all of the, we can cover the operating cost and have some margins for future capital investment. And I put the energy system in the same basket as schools and roads and hospitals and all that sort of stuff. It's the infrastructure of society. And the ideological position that we have around market and pushing it out into the market, I think in the short term definitely paid some benefits in getting it probably run a lot better. And there was more upside in it for investors, and the government obviously gets returns in that because it's a majority shareholder still. But it's hampered growth. And now all the growth that is in the system's small and it's incremental, and the way we specify it has skewed into this renewable space without looking at A, is it cheap, and B, is it reliable?
Yeah, so to sort of wrap that up, we've got this big push for wind, and more specifically lately, there seems to be more discussion about solar expansion and big batteries being put in to store some juice. And effectively, those batteries, as I understand it, are never going to be big enough to store much, unlike a hydro lake. So, if you had to set up the prognosis to change direction tomorrow, what would it say? Would it say nuclear, number one? Would it say nuclear and hydro join and let's ease out of this wind and solar? Or what would it be?
Well, so we've got a short-term need and a longer-term need, right? And the short-term need at the moment is that we're kind of snookered. So we need something fast, right? And the only thing I can think of really that meets the specifications in terms of what's missing from the grid at the moment, which is more base load, is the geothermal. So I think the geothermal has definitely got to be the drive there, and that was something that came out of that Auckland Chamber of Commerce stuff with Simon Bridges' book as well, was that, he was advocating for more geothermal development, and I fully support that. I think that's the way forward in the short term. In the longer term, yeah, I think we have to have a national discussion around nuclear. I think there's been a lot of developments in that space. What was it, Fukushima, and what was in Chernobyl? They don't, none of those sorts of plants don't exist anymore. I mean, they exist obviously, but I mean that's not what people are building now, right? And like the CANDU reactors and the AP1000s and stuff like this, they're a big step forward, both in terms of safety and operability. And I think the nuclear industry has really been hampered by this sort of constant changing of design type thing, and they haven't sort of settled out on something. But that's starting to emerge where they're settling out on standard design, and they've got it now down pretty good now. So, yeah.
So if there's an action point to come out of this discussion, what would it be to our viewers? Is it to lobby your parliamentarians, your MPs, to get it sorted, have a strategy, and make something that's useful for the next 50 years, not the next 5 years, and get the hell out of net zero nonsense? Would that be it?
Well, like I think my recommendation to people would be just to have these discussions, right? Like talk about it in your family or at work or in the pub or wherever, right? Like like talk about energy and try and you have this, you have a biological direct relationship with this energy, right? It's what drives everything in life, right? It all comes back to that. So try explore, like talk about it, and you'll develop more energy literacy, and then you'll be less prone to a lot of these slogans and a lot of the stuff that's and you'll be able to be a lot more nuanced about your understanding, and that'll translate through to a lot of like political pressure over time.
One last question, Larry. We talk about the longer term thing about the MPs and net zero. What about the immediate, what this government promised when it came to repeal the ban on offshore drilling? Where has that reached to you think?
There's still a lot of sovereign risk there, Jaspreet. Like, there's a lot of political risk, like these investments run over multiple electoral cycles, right? So the problem for the like existing fields are pretty well explored. There's not a lot, I don't think, within existing fields. So then you're sort of looking at like what's a new field development, right? And that's quite a long-term thing.
So the
So
time to recoup, you mean how long it takes for the project to actually come up to something?
yeah, so for example, there's a field recently off the coast of Oamaru that was looking quite exciting, and there was some plans to do some exploration drilling there, but even the political environment was such that if you drilled that, could you actually get it to market would have been the question, and would you be able to do anything with it? So there's this real lack of certainty about which direction it'll go from one election to the next. So that makes it unattractive to invest there.
You echo exactly what I heard our ex-Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern speak in the New York Climate Week last year, sometime around September, October, when she said, because she was asked this question, New Zealand's got a new government and it's going to repeal the ban on offshore oil and gas drilling. She said, the electoral cycle usually ceases 9 years, we have a change of government. And she says, we have signaled, my government signaled to the industry that when we come back, we are going to cancel it again. So no one, she says, is going to take a punt on New Zealand. In fact, because of my day job, I got a chance to ask a question to Minister Shane Jones when he was down here in Southland. And I asked him exactly this. I said, Minister, your government, you talk about repealing, but is actually anything going to happen? And I quoted Jacinda Ardern. And Minister Jones was not happy. He says, I can't believe we have sovereignty. We can't have an ex-prime minister saying this. He says, could you send me the quote? And I actually spoke to his chief of staff and forwarded him that exact quote. So you are so right there. The industry has been spooked and maybe even spooked for good from New Zealand.
It's interesting, right? Because I think what you see around the world, right, is that energy primacy is there, right? So when people get crunched and they get really starting to hurt because they can't, operate their businesses, or they can't heat their homes, or they can't cook their dinner, all these sorts of things, right? They don't all sort of political preferences for certain types of energy go out the window, and they'll just take whatever they can get, right? And you get a big groundswell of momentum towards something. And I think that's partially what you saw in the recent German election, right? Like that country's been hurting for a while now, and they want the nuclear back, they want gas back, like if you talk to the average
Energy security. Yep.
they want this stuff back because they can see. They can just see across, even Volkswagen, I think, was laying off, like, it was a lot of people, and a lot of contraction. That's like a Volkswagen, that's a,
industrialization.
yeah, I mean, that's pre-World War II, that business, you know, so it's, yeah, it's wild.
It is wild.
So I think we're going to have to wrap this, Jaspreet, but it's a good 101 again. I mean, I don't, yeah, we'll have to keep repeating this sort of story, as you say, Larry. We're going to have people have the fireside chats and learn about it, because the way I read it, it shouldn't be that hard, but it is. And it's been made hard by, in my opinion, successive governments meddling, but that's again a personal opinion. And so I hope that people have learned a little bit from this discussion today, and that they go to your Substack, New Zealand Energy, and keep up to date with what you're putting out, because you're putting out some really good stuff that all of us can follow. It's not like Commerce Commission speak. It's not, yeah, it's not the Wellington speak. And so we love it. So thanks for your efforts, Larry, and we're going to get you back.
Yeah, no worries, Don, and thank you for the plug there. I mean, it's a bit of a hobby.
It's a great Substack, Larry. Thank you so much for coming on. And no doubt we'll get you back talking about the renewables and the net zero pipeline, pipe dreams that we have here in this country. But thank you so much.